Blog Talk Radio.
I'm terrible with multitasking. I just can't do it for some reason. Okay. okay. And hopefully, we'll be able to get this straightened out here. God. You know, I made a few adjustments to my computer yesterday. And, God, do I regret them. I'm trying to make things, trying to straighten them out since. unbelievable. You know, I've been getting, ever since I put this program in, I've been getting these damn pop-ups like crazy. And, I have to try to block things because it's just driving me crazy. Anyway. Aside from my technical difficulties here, okay, I finally got back to the switchboard, which is great. So if anybody would like to call in or anything tonight, please feel free to do so. But my first poem tonight is called Birches. When I see birches bend to left and right across the lines of straighter or darker trees, I like to think some boys been swinging them. But swinging doesn't bend them down to stay. Ice storms do that. Often you must have seen them loaded with ice in a sunny winter morning, after a rain. They click upon themselves as the breeze rises and turns many colors, as the stir cracks and crazes their enamel. Soon the sun warmth makes them shed crystal bells, shattering and avalanching on the snow crust. Such heaps of broken glass to sweep away, you'd think the inner dome of heaven had fallen. They are dragged to the withered bracken by the load, and they seem not to break, though once they are bowed so low for long, they never right themselves. You may see their trunks arching in the woods, years afterwards, trailing their leaves on the ground like girls on hands and knees that throw their hair before them over their heads to dry in the sun. But I was going to say, when truth broke in with all her matter of fact about the ice storm, I should prefer to have some boy bend them as he went out and in to fetch the cows, some boy too far from town to learn baseball, whose only play was that he found himself, summer or winter, and could play alone. One by one he subdued his father's trees by riding them down over and over again until he took the stiffness out of them, and not one but hung limp. Not one was left for him to conquer. And he learned all there was to learn about not launching out too soon, and so not carrying the tree away clear to the ground. He always kept his poise to the top branches, climbing carefully with the same pains you use to fill a cup up to the brim, and even above the brim. Then he swung outward feet first with a swish, kicking his way down through the air to the ground. So was I once myself a swinger of birches. And so I dream of going back to be. It's when I'm weary of considerations and life is too much like a pathless wood, where your face burns and tickles with the cobwebs broken across it, and one eye is weeping from a twig's having lashed across its open. I'd like to get away from Earth a while, and then come back to it and begin over. May no fate willingly misunderstand me and half grant what I wish and snatch me away not to return. Earth's the right place for love. I don't know where it's likely to go better. I'd like to go by climbing a birch tree and climb black branches up a snow-white trunk toward heaven till the tree could bear no more, but dipped its top and sent me down again. That would be good, both going and coming back. One could do worse than be a swinger of birches. kind of cool, I thought. My next poem is called Mowing. It's a sonnet that reads like a lyric, it states, that it's one of the Frost's early poems. But the tone is already mature, and the spirit is the spirit of the latter work. The poet as laborer identifies himself with his scythe, and as the man and his instrument perform their task, their earnest love brings them to a simple and profound truth. The fact is the sweetest dream that labor knows. And it's called Mowing. Now, I'm reading from a rather old book. It was published in 1962, I believe. Introduction and Commentary by Louis Untermeyer. It's an anthology of Robert Frost poems. And this poem is called Mowing. There was never a sound beside the wood but one, and that was my long scythe, whispering to the ground. What was it? It whispered. I knew not well myself. Perhaps it was something about the heat of the sun, something perhaps about the lack of sound. And that was why it whispered and did not speak. It was no dream of the gift of idle hours or easy gold at the hand of fae or elf. Anything more that the truth would have seemed too weak to the earnest love that laid swale and rose, not without feeble pointed spikes of flowers, and scared a bright green snake. The fact is the sweetest dream that labor knows. My long sigh whispered and left the hay to make. The Mending Wall is my next poem. And I'd like to quote from the author here. It states, "The Strength of the Mending Wall, one of poems' most often quoted poems, rests upon a contradiction. Its two famous lines oppose each other. The poem maintains that something there is that doesn't love a wall, but insists good fences make good neighbors." And I remember my father saying, good fences make good neighbors. I learned throughout my life that good fences do make good neighbors, and or at least keep bad neighbors away from your place. And I want to read this. It's called The Mending Wall. Something there is that doesn't love a wall, that sends the frozen groundswell under it, to spill and spill the upper boulders in the sun, and makes gaps even too great, two can pass abreast. The work of hunters is another thing. I have come after them and made repair, where they have left not one stone on a stone, but they would have the rabbit hiding. But they would have the rabbit out of hiding to please the yelping dogs. The gaps, I mean, no one has seen them made or heard them made, but at spring mending time, we find them there. I let my neighbor know beyond the hill, and on the day we meet to walk the line, and set the wall between us once again. We keep the wall between us as we go, to each the boulders that have fallen to each, and some are lows and some so nearly balls. We have to use a spell to make them balance. Stay where you are until our backs are turned. We wear our fingers rough in handling them. Oh, just another kind of outdoor game, one on a side. It comes to little more. There where it is, we do not need the wall. He is all pine and I am apple orchard. my apple trees will never get across and eat the cones under the pines. I tell him, he only says, good fences make good neighbors. Spring is the mischief in me, and I wonder if I could put a notion in his head. Why do they make good neighbors? Isn't it where there are cows? But here there are no cows. Before I built the wall, I'd asked to know what I was walling in and walling out, and to whom I was like to, and whom I was like to give offense. Something there is that doesn't love a wall, that wants it down. I could say elves to him, but it's not elves exactly, and I'd rather he said it for himself. I see him there bringing a stone, grasping firmly by the top in each hand, like an old stone savage arm. He moves in darkness, as it seems to me, not of woods only and the shade of trees. He will not go farther, he will not go behind his father's saying, and he likes having thought of it so well. He says again, good fences make good neighbors. And I guess the question is, why do we need fences and why are there fences? But we all have fences, we all put them up and tear them down. And that was Robert Frost's wisdom. Good fences make good neighbors. My next poem is called To the Thawing Wind. Come and rain, O loud southwester. Bring the singer, bring the nester. Give the buried flower a dream, make the settled snowbank steam. Find the brown beneath the white, make whatever you do tonight. Bathe my window, make it flow. Melt it as the ice will go. Melt the glass and leave the sticks, like a hermit's crucifix. And burst into my narrow stall, swing the picture on the wall. Run the rattling pages o'er, and scatter poems on the floor. Turn the poet out of door. That was To the Thawing Wind. This next poem is, Robert Frost used to work as a, in his youth, he worked as a, in a thread mill, making thread and thimbles and stuff like that, I guess. But, when he wrote this poem called A Lone Striker, the swinging mill bells changed its rate to tolling like the count of fate. And though at that the tardy man, one failed to make the closing gate, there was a law of God or man that on the one who came too late, the gate for half an hour be locked, his time be lost, his pittance docked. He stood rebuked and unemployed, the straining mill began to shake, the mill, though many, many eyes inscrutably opaque, so that he couldn't look inside to see if some forlorn machine was standing idle for his sake. He couldn't hope its heart would break. And yet he thought he saw the scene. The air was full of dust of wool. A thousand yarns were under pull, but pull so slow, with such a twist, all day from spool to lesser spool, to seldom overtax their strength, they safely grew in slender length, and if one broke by any chance, the spinner saw it at a glance, and the spinner still was there to spin. That's where the human still came in. Her deft hand showed with finger rings, among the harp-like strings, spread of strings. She caught the pieces end to end, and with a touch that never missed, not so much tied as made them blend. Man's ingenuity was good. He saw it plainly where he stood, yet found it easy to resist. He knew another place, a wood, and in it tall as trees were cliffs. And if he stood on one of these, 'twould be among the tops of trees, their upper branches round him wreathing, their breathing mingled with his breathing. If he stood, enough of ifs. He knew a path that wanted walking. He knew a spring that wanted drinking. I thought that wanted further thinking, a love that wanted renewing. Nor was this just a way of talking to save him the expense of doing. With him it bodied action, indeed. The factory was very fine. He wished it all the modern speed. Yet after all, 'twas not divine. That is to say, 'twas not a church. He never would assume that he'd be any institution's need. But he said then, and still would say, if there should ever come a day when industry seemed like to die because he left it in the lurch, or even merely seemed to pine for want of his approval, why, come get him. They knew where to search. And that was Robert Frost, who looked at the factory work. He was late getting there, and decided to take a walk in the woods and, take the day off. I like that. I like that. The next poem I wanted to read tonight is called Two Tramps in Mud Time. This is really a good poem. Out of the mud, two strangers came and caught me splitting wood in the yard. And one of them put me off my aim by hailing cheerily, "Hit them hard!" I knew pretty well why he dropped behind and let the other go on away. I knew pretty well what he had in mind. He wanted to take my job for pay. Good blocks of beech it was I split, and large around at the chopping block. And every piece I squarely hit fell splinterless in a cloven rock. And the blows that a life of self-control spares to strike for the common good, that day giving a loose to my soul, I spent on the unimportant wood. The sun was warm, but the wind was chill. You know how it is with an April day, when the sun is out and the wind is still. You're 1 month on in the middle of May, but if you so much as dare to speak, a cloud comes over the sunlit arch. A wind comes off a frozen peak, and you're 2 months back in the middle of March. And a bluebird comes tenderly up to a light and fronts the wind to unruffle a plume, his song so pitched as not to excite a single flower as yet to bloom. It is snowing a flake, and he half knew winter was only playing possum. Except in color, he isn't blue, but he wouldn't advise a thing to blossom. The water for which we may have to look in summertime with a witching wand is every wheel rut now a brook, and every wheel rut now a brook, and every print of a hoof a pond. And be glad of water, but don't forget the lurking frost and the earth beneath that will steal forth after the sun is set and show on the water its crystal teeth. The time when most I loved my task, these two must make it love it more, make me love it more. But coming with what they came to ask, you'd think I never had felt before the weight of an axe head poised aloft, the grip on earth of outspread feet, the life of muscle rocking soft and smooth and moist in vernal heat. And out of the woods, two hulking tramps, from sleeping God knows where last night, but not long since in the lumber camps. They thought all chopping was theirs of right. Men of wood and lumberjacks. They judged me by their appropriate tool, except as a fellow handled an axe. They had no way of knowing a fool. Nothing on either side was said. They knew they had but to stay their stay, and all their logic would fill my head, as that I had no right to play with what was another man's work for gain. My right might be love, but theirs was need, and where the two exist in twain, theirs was the better right. I agreed, but yield who will to their separation. My object in living is to unite my avocation and my vocation, as my two eyes make one in sight. Only where love and need are one, and the work is play for mortal stakes, is the deed ever really done for heaven and the future sakes. And I enjoyed this. This is a very, very famous poem by Robert Frost. For those who, I mean, today he's not read very much. You never hear about him. Although he was probably America's great, one of our greatest poets. Because his poems are metered. They're metrical. They're old-fashioned, if you will. But, you know, Robert Frost never made it to the 21st century, and he only made it, through to, I believe he lived into the 1970s, if I remember right. He was quite old. I think he was about in his 90s when he passed away. But he was a man who saw the changes in American society, but kept his roots in nature and in a practical wisdom, if you will, that nature brings. It's like, for instance, where I live here in Connecticut, in the Northwest Connecticut. It's really quite a beautiful place, and the surrounding hills and the woodland and so on. And there's so few places like this that aren't overtaken by, you know, people and places and factories and highways and byways and whatever, you know. And it's a small, well-preserved area that some people know about, but not really. And it's nice like that. The towns are true New England towns, and the people are truly New England people. Stoic and, independent. And kind of like Robert Frost. But more in the sense that they're displaced. Many of them here are displaced New Yorkers, but those that are here year round are quite practical people, I've found, and quite interesting to be here. But what I was getting at is the beauty of nature is such that it just inspires you daily. And Lila is quite a gardener. She's got a tremendous green thumb, and we have a beautiful garden and lovely backyard. And I actually built the patio myself about 5 years ago, and I'm very, very proud of that. But I was able to do that. But the and it's quite a good size one, and it's held up very well over the last 5 years. But there's something like these, like Frost's connection to nature, but also his connection to physical labor and his connection to labor, understanding it, understanding the value of it and the joy of it, and experiencing the season, experiencing the beautiful day, but experiencing the chopping wood. You know, anybody's ever chopped wood, they know what it's like, and it feels good to be able to split a piece of wood, you know, down the middle and get it done right and pack it up and so on and so forth, or pile it up. There's a joy. It's tough work, but it's great if you have to do that, and you know, you burn wood for a living, and so on. I did a lot of that up when I lived in Maine. I used to live in Maine. Grew up there, so I knew what it was like to split wood or pile wood or work the fields and things like that. But getting back to Frost, I just wanted to make that comment because so many people have lost touch with nature, especially those people in the cities and suburbs that are, you know, people don't even grow flowers, you know, in their yards or in their houses, you know, their pots and stuff like that. There's just no connection to nature, and because of that, we have no connection to, very little connection to ourselves, and we're lost. And we're always trying to buy something new or do something new or some exciting adventure, if you will. But, you know, it's the land and the earth and the nature and the flowers and the trees and the animals and the birds. They inspire you every day. And to have those around you connect you so closely to the cosmic world, you know, the universe, because you know that it's beautiful, and it should be beautiful, and it can be beautiful, and the more you work at it, and the more you live it, the more you appreciate it, you know, and came to the door at eve, and he spoke the bridegroom fair. He bore a green white stick in his hand, and for all burden care. He asked with his eyes more than his lips for a shelter for the night, and he turned and looked at the road affair without a window light. The bridegroom came forth onto the porch. And let us look at the sky and question what of the night to be, stranger, you and I. The woodbine leaves littered the yard. The woodbine berries were blue. Autumn, yes, winter was in the wind. Stranger, I wish I knew. Within the bride in the dusk alone, bent over the open fire, her face rose red, and the glowing coal, and the thought of her heart's desire. The bridegroom looked at the weary road. He saw but her within, and wished her heart in a case of gold, and pinned with a silver pin. The bridegroom thought it little to give a dole of bread, a purse, heartfelt prayer for the poor of God or for the rich a curse. But whether or not a man was asked to mar the love of two by harboring woe in the bridal house, the bridegroom wished he knew.
Majestically for years, and grew on his farm, and
you know, and then all of a sudden some shithead, you know, some jerk, some young wretch, okay, cuts the thing down, drags it home, and dresses it up and puts a stupid star on the top of it, okay, and then spends it over Christmas and throws it out, chops it up for wood, and it kills its life. And it's like, not only is there a theft of his property, but there's a theft of the life of the tree. And for such a stupid tradition as Christmas, you know. So, yeah, what can I say? But that's the Robert Frost that so inspired so many people. This is another, this one's a little longer, but it's still a beautiful poem. It's called The Woodpile. Out walking in the frozen swamp one gray day, I paused and said, I will turn back from here. No, I will go on further, and we shall see. The hard snow held me, save where now and then one foot went through. The view was all in line, straight up and down, all of tall, slim trees. Too much alike to mark or name a place by, so as to say for certain I was here, or somewhere else. I was just far from home. A small bird flew before me. He was careful to put a tree between us when he lighted, and say no word to tell me who he was, who was so foolish as to think what he thought. He thought that I was after him for a feather, the white one in his tail, like one who takes everything said as personal to himself. One flight out sideways would have undeceived him, and then there was a pile of wood for which I forgot him and let him, his little fear, carry him off the way I might have gone. Without so much as wishing him good night, he went behind it to make his stand. It was a cord of maple cut and split and piled and measured 4x4x8, and not another like it could I see. No runner tracks in the snow looped near it. And it was old, sure, than this year's cutting, or even last year's or the year before. The wood was gray and the bark warping off it, and the pile somewhat sunken. Clematis was wound strings round and round it like a bundle. And what held it through on one side was a tree still growing, and on one a stake and prop. And these latter about to fall. I thought that only someone who lived in turning to fresh tasks could so forget his handiwork on which he spent himself the labor of his axe, and leave it there far from a useful fireplace to warm and frozen swamp, as to warm the frozen swamp as best it could with the slow, smokeless burning of decay.
In
now these numberless years, the elves, although they are no less there, all songs of the woods is crushed. All song of the woods is crushed like some wild, easy, shattered rose. Come, be my love in the wet woods. Come, where the boughs rain when it blows. There is the gale to urge behind and brute our singing down, and the shallow waters aflutter with wind from which to gather your gown. What matter if we go clear to the west and come not through dry shod, for wilding brooch shall wet your breast, the rain fresh golden rod. Oh, never this well-known east wind swells, but it seems like the sea's return, the ancient lands where it left the shells before the age of the fern. And it seems like the time when, after doubt, our love came back amain. Oh, come forth into the storm and rout, and be my love in the rain. That was called a Lion Storm song. I don't know, it's just certain things that, the quality of his poems that just, capture you, you know. And I have a few more minutes to the show, and I wanted to read this. A patch of old snow. There is a patch of old snow in a corner that I should have guessed was a blowaway paper the rain had brought to rest. It is speckled with grime as if small print overspread it. The news of a day I've forgotten, if I ever write it. A time to talk. When a friend calls to me from the road and slows his horse to a meaning walk, I don't stand still and look around on all the hills I haven't hoed and shout from where I am, "What is it?" No, not as there is a time to talk. I thrust my hoe in the mellow ground, blade end up and 5 feet tall, and plod. I go up to the stone wall for a friendly visit. Anytime is good to talk. You break away from the from your work. And kind of fun. I wanted to read the next one, Evening in a Sugar Orchard, and I wanted to end tonight as if I can find it. For some reason I marked it, but I must have dropped out. I love this one, a tree at my window. And stopping by the woods on a snowy evening, I would read that one. I'll end the night with that. But I wanted to read Tree at My Window. Actually, before I read that one, I think I'll read A Serious Step Lightly Taken. Between two burrs on the map was a hollow-headed snake. The burrs were hills, and snake was a stream, and the hollow head was a lake. And the dot in front of a name was what should be a town, and there might be a house we could buy for only a dollar down. With two wheels low in the ditch, we left our boiling car and knocked at the door of a house we found, and there today we are. It is turning 300 years on our Cisatlantic shore, where family after family name will make it 300 more. For our name farming here, aloof yet not aloof, enriching soil and increasing stock, repairing fence and roof, and 100,000 days of front page paper events, a half a dozen major wars, and 45 presidents. And I love that because, you know, the House has been there for 300 years, you know, and it'll be there for 300 years more. And, you know, they said time for God, which is his home. The next one is called The Tree at My Window. Tree at my window, window tree, my sash is lowered when night comes upon. But let there never be curtain drawn between you and me. Vague dream head lifted out of the ground, and thing next most diffused to cloud, not all your light tongues talking aloud could be profound. But tree, I have seen you taken and tossed, and if you have seen me when I sleep, you have seen me when I was taken and swept and all but lost. That day she put your heads together. That day she put our heads together. Fate had her imagination about her. Your head so much concerned with outer, mine with inner weather. I guess that something that, I have trees outside my windows that I'm rather partial to, rather friends of. I see them as friends. These great trees that shade me in the winter, or summer, rather. You know, break the wind in the winter and stop snow from banging up my house. Trees are great things, and we all have affection for them. And I have a crabapple tree in the front yard, and I'm so I love that tree. And for some reason, that tree always blossoms the week of my birthday. Sometimes, some years, it's actually blossomed exactly on my birthday. And for those of you who know what a crabapple tree looks like, is there, some are white, but this one happens to be pink. And it's absolutely beautiful with these buds that are laden with these blossoms every spring. And you were truly like Frost here in the tree at his window. You truly gain a respect for nature, and you almost become, you personify that relationship that you have with it and with your surrounding nature, and that's why that kind of struck me. You know, the tree at my window, and I have about a few more minutes left. Yeah, I can sneak a couple more in. Again, I let me see. The minor bird. I have wished a bird would fly away and not sing by my house all day. Have clapped my hands at him from the door when it seemed as if I could bear no more. And the fault must partly have been in me. The bird was not to blame for his key. And of course, there must be something wrong in wanting to silence any song. There's some more here, but they're a little bit long, and I really wanted to end tonight with one of my favorite songs. But This is a beautiful one. And this is the one. There's just a couple here, but I wanted to end with my favorite. I'll read this one. Design. I found a dimpled spider, fat and white, on a white heel all, holding up a moth like a white piece of rigid satin cloth. Assorted characters of death and blight, mixed ready to begin the morning rite, like the ingredients of a witch's broth. A snowdrop spider, a flower like froth. The dead wings carried like a paper kite. What had the flower to do with being white? The wayside blue an innocent hewell. What brought the kindred spider to that height? Then steered the white moth thither in the night. What but a design of darkness to appall, if design govern in a thing so small? And another real short one here that I'll read. Here comes real, it's called Fireflies in the Garden. Here comes real stars to fill the upper skies, and here on earth come emulating flies, that though they never equal stars in size, and they were never really stars at heart, achieve at times a very star-like start. Only, of course, they can't sustain the part. I love that. And I'll end with one of Cross's most famous poems. Stopping by the woods on a snowy evening. Whose woods these are, I think I know. His house is in the village, though. He will not see me stopping here to watch his woods fill up with snow. My little horse must think it queer to stop without a farmhouse near, between the woods and frozen lake, the darkest evening of the year. He gives his harness bells a shake to ask if there is some mistake. The only other sounds that's the sweep of easy wind and downy flake. The woods are lovely, dark, and deep, but I have promises to keep, and miles to go before I sleep, and miles to go before I sleep. And with that, I'll end tonight's show. And I want to thank everybody who's listening or listened, and for your own sake, check out Robert Frost's work. I think you'll find it pleasant and amusing, and quite inspirational. And as a poet, I've been for many, many years, I always appreciated, you have to appreciate the masters, and Robert Frost is definitely one of them. And I want to thank everybody, wish you a nice weekend. We won't be on tomorrow night, but we will be back on Tuesday night. I wish you all the best. And let's see. I think I'll end tonight with another song.